21st Century HR is a podcast exploring how to build better businesses through modern people practices and approaches. It's brought to you by my firm, Amplify. Amplify provides HR executive search and strategic consulting services that help companies build better organizations. From employer brand development and execution to global talent strategies, Amplify develops custom solutions that help clients from Hootsuite to SpaceX optimize their recruiting capabilities. Amplify also hosts a new community for HR leaders called the Ecosystem. The Ecosystem was designed to bring modern HR leaders around the world together to share ideas, inspiration, and support. Learn more at amplifytalent.com. Hey, what's up, everyone? Welcome to 21st Century HR Live. I'm your host, Lars Schmidt. Welcome to episode 4. So we are almost 1 week into our first week of broadcasting. Thanks so much for all the viewers who are tuning in out there. For those of you checking out a show for the first time, this is designed to be an interactive show. So I'll obviously have questions for my guests. But if you have questions as well, wherever you're streaming this, feel free to ask questions. I'll be sure to adjust volume so that you're not getting a volume from multiple channels. That's my that's the hack with LinkedIn. LinkedIn has to air in a different channel so I can monitor the questions there. So now you're getting under the hood. Anyway, back to the show. So my guest today is Lori Rudiman. She is a lot of things. She's an author. She is an HR consultant. She is somebody who is a good friend of mine. That's probably the most important title of hers to me. But she's fantastic. And so we're going to spend some time talking about writing books, the field of HR, HR in the current climate of a global pandemic, and cats and a range of other things. So if you have questions for Lori, wherever you're streaming this, add your question in the comment box. Hopefully I will be able to catch that and cover that with Lori live on air. So with that, let me bring on my good friend Lori onto the show. So Lori, how are you?
I'm great, Lars. How you doing? This platform is awesome.
Yeah, thanks. It's you know, we're always in pilot mode. You know that.
We are. Little experiments.
All right. So I don't need your intro. I know you very well. There will be viewers out there. Most of them probably don't. They know who LFR is, but some of them may not. So if you don't mind to kick things off, why don't you just give a brief intro and background on you?
Yeah. For all six of you who give a rip, I am indeed Lori Rudiman. I used to be a really disgruntled, unhappy HR lady, and now I'm a disgruntled and unhappy writer, speaker, and entrepreneur. A little cynical, a little caustic for some people, but I try to really tackle some truths about the world of work. So I feel like I was born to really explore why people hate working, which is a terrible reason to be born, but that is my mission, that is my purpose, and that's what I'm obsessed about. I don't know, Lars, I think it stems from the fact that I myself hate working. You know, like I hate having obligations, I hate being bossed around, and yet I like money and I like nice things. So somewhere in that complicated miasma of my mind comes my life's work, and that's what my book and all of my blogging is all about. I don't know. What do you think?
You know, I'd say that's right. I think that okay. Let me
take work, Lori. That's true.
Agree with you outright. So I think you're somebody who doesn't like work, and obviously likes. I mean, we all like money. We all need to live. But I think that where you probably undersell yourself a little bit is I think you do have a deep passion for the field that actually may not come through or may be misinterpreted in some of your writing. I think that some people might take kind of some of your writing and your posts, either out of context or they will read them through their own lens because you're not afraid to speak truth to power. You're not afraid to be very honest and real and authentic and challenge common wisdom, common assumptions. And for me, it's one of the things I've always admired about you. But I think for readers that may not know you and they don't really know how you tick, if you just read a single blog post without any context of who you are and what you're about, you may jump to a different conclusion than the one that you kind of intended when you wrote the piece.
Yeah, I think that's fair. And I also question a lot of the comments I get from first-time readers who are angry when I'm so perceived negative about HR. I'm like, well, if you're so smart and great, why are you stuck in the world of HR that's broken? And I'm like out here writing about it. So let's just get something straight here. But I do weirdly love the world of human resources because I think it's the epicenter of work, power, politics, and money. There is so much good that people can do in the world of human resources, but instead we get caught up in these like stupid horizontal battles, or we forget that we're part of a system that really has disenfranchised so many. You know, if HR were so great, why do we still have pay inequities? Why is there discrimination? Why are there surprise layoffs? Why is it that every time we open up a new rec, it's like a new process all over again, right? I mean, there's so much broken in this world. And if we just fixed a few little things, we could have a big difference. But instead, we fight with Judy in procurement about whether or not we have authority to sign a contract, or we fight with someone in finance because this is really part of our domain and it's not finance. I mean, it just makes no sense, the battles that we get caught up in, because if we really did HR right, we could be so powerful.
I mean, there are
That's like my thing.
Well, there are a lot of needless battles. And I know we've even had conversations around like the difference between kind of modern HR, or like, obviously we're on a show called 21st Century HR, right? Like that progressive wing of the function and the legacy wing of the function and all the different things that each of them carry. And I want to get into some of your perspectives on the field at large right now. And I think in particular how HR leaders are kind of managing through these times. But I want to come back to that, because first I want to talk to you about your book. You're getting ready to publish a book. You've been writing a book. You've written a book now. Now it is in the final process and getting ready for publishing. So I want to hear about the book, but I want to actually just do a quick rewind, because for viewers, again, that aren't familiar with you, you know, way, way back before this book happened, you were one of the very first kind of, you know, HR bloggers, one of the people really writing about the world of work under the blog Punk Rock HR. You know, your writing has evolved. I think in my mind, and I've told you this before, you know, you're one of the top 2 to 3, if not top, writer in the HR space. And so I always love reading whatever you put out there, but I want to learn for myself, but also kind of bring viewers through your kind of evolution in writing and how kind of the blog took you to, you know, more writing and then ultimately led to a book.
Yeah. Thank you for asking. When I had a full-time job back in the day, I was really unhappy and I needed a way to kind of vent about it and still show up for work every day. And so I discovered this format, this platform called blogging. And so I was blogging anonymously while working as an HR leader at Pfizer. And during that time, Pfizer was reducing its headcount from over 100,000 employees down to about 50,000 employees. So it was a really stressful time. And I was always on the road and always flying and delivering bad news. And so whether or not it was appropriate, that's probably to be discussed. I was blogging. And then a couple years into this, I was just so exhausted. And my blog anonymously had so many viewers. And I thought, there's got to be a way that I can monetize this. So I asked for and received a severance package at Pfizer and launched this kind of career of being a writer. And this blog, once I attached my name to it, really opened up opportunities for me to go out and speak and to have an opinion about the world of work and the world of human resources. And from there, I was afforded opportunities to consult with HR tech companies and to consult with HR departments to really rethink how to approach problems that traditionally may have looked one way, but we're looking a new way in the 21st century. So it was really an evolution, like just writing about myself and writing about what I experienced turned into this opportunity to write about an industry. But I think the most important thing is that I took a risk on myself and my ideas and believed in them. It's so easy when you work in a corporate infrastructure to have imposter syndrome or to wonder, do I deserve to have this point of view? Am I smart? Am I as smart as somebody who got their MBA from Stanford or who has a PhD from some esteemed institution? And once I stopped doubting myself and just said, you know, I have an opinion, I'm going to take a risk, doors opened up for me. And that path is not for everybody, but I really got sick and tired of playing small. And so I took a risk and started to play a little bit bigger. And so this blog, this really crappy little thing that I started way back before anybody knew about blogging, has turned into so much. It's turned into a lifestyle. It's turned into an opportunity to speak globally. And now it's turned into an opportunity to write a really big book, which is your original question, Lars, like, what's the book all about? And the book is all about the world of work, how not to be a sucker. And I really try to take these big concepts of HR, and instead of writing these big consultative driven sentences, I try to take big ideas and put them into small sentences so that everybody can understand how HR works and how they can get ahead at work and in their lives. So that's what that's all about. Thanks for asking.
Yeah. So when is the book coming out? When can we get our hands on it?
Yeah, it'll be in bookstores, if that even exists, and that's a thing, in January of 2021 after the election, but it'll be up on Amazon for pre-sale in September. So I'm pretty stoked about that. Right now, we're at the phase where we're working on covers, and the book is called Betting on You, How to Put Yourself First and Finally Take Control of Your Career. And the one caveat is that I won't allow a gambling cover, like no poker players, there are no roulette wheels.
Thank you.
We're trying to figure out what that cover would indeed look like. I mean, it's going to be 24 karat gold. Come on now.
But look, Laura, you've always had good taste. So I expect
Taj Mahal taste. That's
right. You have golden toilet taste. And I'm very, very proud to call you a friend.
Yes.
Writing a book is hard, right? The whole process of it is like, hey, let's use understatements to this. It'll be fun. Writing a book is incredibly difficult. So if there's a viewer out there, and I imagine there is some, you know, writers or aspiring writers who are watching this, what advice would you have? Like, you've already gone through, you know, the process of, you know, pitching a publisher, you know, writing a book, manuscript, all of that stuff. Like, obviously it hasn't come out yet, but you're in the, you know, the ninth inning in terms of like all the prep and production before it actually goes out. What have you learned through that? What advice would you have for viewers that are contemplating writing a book of their own?
Yeah. You know, there's this myth out there that book writing has been democratized and anybody can write a book. And, that's true. You can. But there is still a snobby system, a hierarchy about book and book selling, book writing and book selling. I'm such a great extemporaneous speaker. Sorry about this. Lars, I literally have not talked to another human being face to face except for my husband in 60 days since March 1st. So this is really challenging for me to like stand up and talk about stuff, especially to a screen. But there is a hierarchy of writing books. And I think if you want to be on TV, if you want to share your ideas at scale, you've got to shoot for the stars. You've got to write a traditionally published book. And how do you do that? For me, I got a book writing coach. And so I spent money to figure out how to write the right proposal, how to pick an agent, and how to pitch a book to major publishers. And I used this guy by the name of Nick Morgan at Public Words. And he delivered on his promises, right? I mean, I got an audience with an agent. I got an audience with over 5 major publishers, and my book went to auction. There was actually a little bit of a bidding war, and I got a pretty hefty book advance. So that's the way to teach people at scale. And even with that, there's no guarantee that my book is going to be successful. The next echelon is writing through a business publisher like a McGraw or a Wiley. And then I think there are stories of people who have self-published books and become successful, like Michael Stanier Bungay, I think that's his name. He was on my podcast. Forgive me for butchering that name, but he wrote The Coaching Habit, and that was self-published at first, and he has since sold 300,000 copies. But that's the anomaly, right? There still is this weird hierarchy, and traditional publishing is the way to go. I hate being the bearer of that message. And hopefully the work that I do over the next decade can help to deconstruct that and show people secrets around the world of writing books, just like I've shown people secrets in the world of human resources.
Yeah. And that's definitely helpful context in terms of framing the book. And I would even add to that, you know, if you want to write, obviously I think a book is what most writers aspire to, and, you know, books, plural. But writing, especially if you're just starting off, start with a blog, just get your thoughts down, and don't worry about it being perfect. Right. And don't worry about it being a rhythm that somebody else suggests you should have. You know, I think for me, when I first started writing again, I followed your stuff extensively. And I remember, Charlie Judy was another HR blogger whose writing I followed quite a bit. And I think I wrote a guest post on his blog. And when I did that, you know, then I started writing, and my initial writing was okay, like at best. Like it definitely was not, you know, it was not great, but it was fine. I didn't need it to be great. And there are some people who write every day, and there's a school of thought of, you know, if you want to be a good writer, write every day. Yeah. And for some people that works. For me, it absolutely didn't work. I think I lasted a week and it sucked. And like the way that I write, I have to have something I want to convey. I have to have something something to say. Yeah. I can't just pick up and write on a topic and just produce. And that's a gift that, you know, that you have, that a lot of people have, I don't have. And I think for everybody, you have to kind of calibrate what works best for you based on your own style. So, you know, consume lots of other content, consume lots of other ideas. Don't feel pressure by somebody else's kind of writing rhythms and approach and just assume that you have to emulate that in order to be that kind of writer. Don't aspire to be that kind of writer. Be you, be informed and stylistically maybe influenced by other people, but you know, don't feel the need to replicate, you know, a Lori or somebody else, because you're just lead to crushing disappointment.
But, you know, Malcolm Gladwell was right, though, that practice, however many hours it takes for you to achieve expertise, is important. And so the fact that I started blogging back in the day and, you know, it took me, you know, it only took me 15 years to be an overnight success, right? But I did all of this writing, all of this practice that allowed me to get to a position where I could get a coach and put together a book proposal and then have the esteemed opportunity of writing a manuscript that was torn apart, ripped apart, put back together. It took a lot of work. And so I think anybody who believes that a good idea equals a book is a little naive, but I don't think people really believe that. And I think most people know that good writing is good thinking, and good thinking comes from practice. And so for me, Lars, my style is to write every day, even if I'm not publishing every day, but I'm also reading every day. And I think that's also essential for me, and not just reading stupid blogs, including mine, but I'm reading fiction, I'm reading poetry. I'm trying to get a lot of different content and a lot of different formats into my brain so that I can be a better and more coherent writer.
Well, I think it's working for you. Those diversified sources are they're paying off. And I want to remind viewers, if you're watching and you have questions for Lori, feel free to add those into the comment section or tweet wherever you're streaming this, and we'll do our best to cover them on air. And I do have our first viewer question from Michael Vaughn. He's watching us on YouTube right now. His question is, what do you believe to be the biggest barriers for HR achieving your vision of great HR?
Yeah. You know, I don't think there's one barrier. I think there are a couple of barriers. First, there's the barrier of like institutional classism, sexism, racism. All of that is bearing down on the world of work. And then to expect one function that is primarily populated by women and also people of disaffected minority groups to rise up and take control and to fight back and to fix the world of work is definitely naive on my part. There's no way that one group like that is going to be able to do it alone. So, you know, there are these institutional barriers that are in place, but sometimes there are the barriers within ourselves. When I worked in human resources, even with progressive people who were doing cool and interesting work, they were limited by some of their own self-doubt. Like, I don't know if I can do this. Do I have the authority? Do I have the bandwidth? Or because they're like part of the middle class, they're afraid of getting fired. You know, I want to go out on a risk for this, but if I go out on a limb for this, can I afford to spend my capital for the next time something happens? So there's just this inherent fear. But I would say the best HR professionals I know are okay working themselves out of a job. They know, they have the conviction of their own beliefs that if they get fired or they do it wrong, there's always going to be something else out there for them. So I don't know, fear holds us back. That's like such a stupid and trite thing to say, but it definitely holds back HR professionals. So whatever you fear, you got to face it, and you have to stand up for what you believe in. And if you get fired, well, you know me, you know Lars, we're going to fight to get you placed in your next great position.
Yeah, you know, I'm glad that you touched on a term that I think is really essential for modern HR, and that's courage.
Yeah,
I think you have to be courageous. You cannot be impactful in your role without courage, because there's going to be times when you're going to have to speak unpopular truths. There are going to be times when you're going to have to save the company and your executive peers from themselves. And that's not easy. You know, nobody is going to be an impactful, transformative HR leader if they're a, you know, yes person, and they're not willing to kind of stand up and take a stance. And, you know, hopefully it's an informed stance. It's not just, you know, like I'm just being combative, but you've got to be able to step away, and you've got to be able to put yourself at risk, at times, if that's what the right thing is for the company and for the employees, and for the team. And so that courage, having courage, displaying courage, I think is essential for modern HR leaders.
Good point. I do want to say there's also this element of self-leadership that's so important. I have coached so many HR leaders who are like, you don't know my CEO. He's such a dick. Or you don't know what I have to deal with politically. I'm like, yeah, I do. Why do you think I don't do that job anymore? It's terrible. And at some point, you have to stop looking to the CEO like he's your dad and he should behave a certain way, because chances are it is a him and he's not behaving that way. And actually, that's what gives you such a great opportunity to go in and fix the world of work. Like, fight that battle. Don't blame the circumstances. The circumstances are what put you in that role. Now go and fix it. So sometimes we have to be the leader that we seek in other people. And that is a tough message for a lot of HR professionals who are like, where is my good leader? And it's like, guess what? You don't have one. Sorry, lady, step up.
You got to look in the mirror at that point. So
absolutely.
So let's take that statement to current times, because obviously, you know, we're recording this episode in the early stages of a global pandemic. Nothing is like it was 2 months ago. And I think that certainly translates to the HR field and to HR leaders specifically. So from your observations, I know you've got a pretty vast network of practitioners. What are you seeing? How do you see kind of the changes that have been taking place with COVID-19, you know, impacting HR leaders specifically?
I'm so glad you asked this question, because there are HR leaders around the globe who are proud of themselves for responding to COVID. They have stood up a work from home program. I hate that phrase, but they've stood it up, and they've implemented layoffs, but they've done it with compassion, and they've kept the hiring process going even when things are tough. But on the other side of that, they're working 80 hours a week, or they're working at different times of the day while trying to balance work-life challenges. Maybe they're caring for their children or caring for an older parent, and things are chaotic in their own lives. And I'm like, you know, congratulations for standing up a work from home program like it's 2014. Like, I'm not going to pat you on the back for that, but okay, you did it. But the real challenge, the real opportunity in front of you is to look at how you are working in all of that chaos. Look at your mood, look at your mindset, and to fix that. Because if you fix that, you're going to fix a problem for tens of thousands of employees out in the world. So it's not about whether or not you're focused on the next strategy or the next pivot for your organization. Fix your own employee experience, and you're going to make a difference in the lives of so many other individuals. So if you're working at 3 a.m. because that's the only time you can fit in your work, maybe you need to have a conversation in your organization about how 8 hours in the office isn't the same as working at home. I don't know, Lars, what do you think about all that?
Yeah, I think that, you know, this situation is really making us need to recalibrate the definition of work and the definition of boundaries. And I think what's so interesting is that this is so multidimensional. The impact, the way this is impacting every individual employee is different, right? You know, some are parents, some have underlying health conditions that increase anxiety. Some are taking care of older parents. Some have parents in another city that they can't see, that they're worried about. And the levels of stress and anxiety are so high. I think for companies that aren't really recalibrating how they're defining work and where contributions can happen are really missing the boat. And they're creating a lot of additional stress on employees who are already dealing with a lot. So I think it's really important to redefine that. And I think for HR leaders, again, like your analogy of putting on your oxygen mask first before you put on, you know, your seatmates masks, I think that's really important. If you're not taking care of yourself, you're not going to be in the best position to support your leadership peers and your employees and making good decisions for the company. So I think that that's really important. And I think that, you know, there are some HR, leaders that are, you know, they're really concerned with how to maintain culture and engagement. And so they're creating all these different programs, like we're going to do a Zoom happy hour and we're going to, you know, bring your kid to your desk day and things like that, which are all great. But I think that you have to be really deliberate in the messaging around those things, that all of those things are optional, because you may have some employees who are desperate for that connection and they will be in every one of those meetings because maybe they're living in a studio in New York by themselves. And then you're going to have others that have parents and other needs. And they're like, I can't possibly, like, it takes everything I have to be able to just have this little bit of output to work per day. And so I think it's really important just to be mindful of the different kind of situations that your employees are. And, you know, specific to you, like life in quarantine, I'm stoked to be the second human you've seen in 60 days. So that's a privilege for me.
Human I know. Yeah.
All right. Life in quarantine. Like, what is your, tell me about your life. Like, how are you getting by? What is your, I wouldn't even say like an average day, cause I don't even know what that is, but like, how is your life in general in self-isolation there?
Well, thank you for asking. You know, there is this myth out there right now that Zoom and Skype and FaceTime are the way to collaborate and connect. By the way, every HR professional should question that, because who said Zoom is the right way to collaborate? Zoom said it. Like, nobody of esteemed authority is out there going, you know what, Zoom is a really great way to collaborate. No, it's a marketing campaign. So we need to keep this in mind when we all rush to get on the screen. And, you know, I have actually talked to a few people through the screen, but I find that this is not my natural way to communicate. So I wake up in the morning, I write, I get mad at Donald Trump and the way that we blew the month of February in responding to the coronavirus. I get mad that we don't have enough testing. I eat some lunch. You know, like, every day is both Groundhog Day and it's a little bit different. So my husband works in the pharmaceutical industry, and everybody still needs drugs. That supply chain is really important. So he's still going to work a few days a week, going above and beyond the CDC guidelines, right? Everybody is really sensitive, but I don't want to go out and expose myself to something, expose my husband to it, and then he takes it to work. And so I'm taking my quarantine pretty seriously. And the burden is not just to make sure I don't get sick, but it's to make sure that other people don't get sick. And, you know, we tell people to have a sense of empathy, but with empathy comes an obligation. And sometimes that causes anxiety and stress. And that's definitely causing me anxiety and stress, because if I get anybody sick, I will never forgive myself. On top of this, my childhood best friend and her husband in Chicago caught COVID. He actually got it at work and brought it to my best friend. And it was just heartbreaking to see them go through this. They had to send their daughters away. They were worried, can we give this to our animals? They were so sick. And there was nothing I can do except check in with her on a daily basis and go, are you in the hospital? Are you alive? Like, what's going on? So it's definitely been a stressful 2 months. And again, I was paying attention to the news. My last trip was March 1st. And that first week of March, my husband and I were starting to lock ourselves down. And if we could do it, the federal government could have done it. So I don't know, Lars, it's been stressful.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate you sharing that. And I think it's, it's obviously a difficult situation to be in. And you're right. Like, I think that there's obviously, as we're starting to see more conversations around return to work and what that looks like. The reality is, it's like, it's not, you know, if for your own perspective, you have a hard time, you think, I'm young, I'm healthy, I'm fine, like, okay, that's a risk for you. But like, this is a situation where we're all reliant on each other. Like, we're, you know, the old cliche, you're only as strong as your weakest link.
Right.
If we start breaking that, I mean, the conversation, again, this will date this podcast, but, you know, yesterday with the mayor of Las Vegas, you know, saying that they want her city to be a test case, that everybody should go there and gamble and go to sports. I'm just like, what are you, like, how disconnected from science are you? So we could spend an hour there. I'm going to cut that one off because we're almost at the show's end and I want to make time for one good thing. So when we close out the show, one of the things that we do is we ask our guests to share one good thing. So it could be something you've read, something you've learned, something you've thought about, a conversation you've had. So for Lori, for you, share one good thing with us.
Yeah. Well, I was feeling a little stressed about my business earlier this week and reached out to a few friends. And my friend and mentor, Don McPherson was Johnny on the spot. He responded. He's like, when do you want to talk? How can I be helpful? Like, let's get on the phone right away. And I think compassion and really being there for other people is what's going to drive us to connect. So I wanted to take this opportunity to thank Don McPherson and tell him how much I love him and appreciate him in my life. He's great.
Yeah, well, I'm also fortunate to know Don and can echo your thoughts. He's a very solid guy, and we all need those friends, and we also all need to be comfortable calling those friends, right? So I think that it's, you know, we're carrying so much weight right now, and I think that we all need these reminders that it's okay not to be okay, and that when we need our friends, we've got to raise our hand and say, like, I'm not okay, I need help. And so you know, if you're listening, you're struggling, don't forget that. It's really important. So, Lori, thanks so much for coming on. It's been awesome catching up. Definitely stoked for your book. I will be keeping my eye on when that pre-sale goes in place in Amazon, so I can be one of the early pre-purchasers.
Lori, and, get a free copy.
Yeah. Well, okay, free copy. All right. I will not give you money then. I will take your free copy. I expect a full LFR signature in that said copy. And what's the best way for people, if viewers want to connect with you after the show, what's the best way to do that?
Sure. Anybody can go to my podcast, Punk Rock HR. Go to punkrockhr.com. That'll forward you over to my website. And I would love to hear what you're thinking, what you're feeling, and how you're doing in this COVID world.
Great. Well, Lori, thanks so much for coming on. We will be back same time tomorrow, noon Eastern. Tomorrow's going to kick off a new series within a series. So every Friday, I'll be having office hours with my friend Craig Fisher. So Craig and I are going to talk about technology, tools, music, lots of random stuff. It's going to be interactive. It's going to be a show within a show. So hope to see you there. And thanks to all of you who've been tuning in this week. I'm stoked to see what we've built so far. And I will see you all tomorrow. Take care and stay safe.
Thanks for listening to this episode of 21st Century HR. If you want to hear more episodes like this or read stories from the 21st Century HR Fast Company series, go to 21stcenturyhr.com. And if you want to make your podcast just a little more awesome, be sure to subscribe to the show on iTunes, Spotify, SoundCloud, or whatever podcast platform your ears desire. You'll find all the subscribe links on the website. And if you enjoy the podcast, do me a favor and share it with your peers, your network, your boss, and your CEO. Help me get the podcast into the ears of anyone who wants to know what HR and recruiting looks like when done really well. They'll thank you for it, and so will I. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next episode.